and welcome to the Logic Consortium. Today, we're going to be talking with development economist Paul Collier about his recent book, The Plundered Planet, where he really talks about natural resources and their potential in the development of countries.
So the big story of the next decade is going to be resource discoveries in the poorest countries on Earth.
And we're going to be talking about natural resource discovery in the context of his new book, The Plundered Planet, and how there is a need to understand the decision-making process that goes into the extraction of these resources.
The key argument in The Plundered Planet is that the only way that's going to happen is if society by society, a critical mass of informed citizens builds up that understands the decision chain.
So we'll be talking about his arguments in the book and a few other things. Thanks so much. Professor Collier, thanks so much for coming on the program.
That's okay. Is this sound quality good enough?
I think it sounds okay. I wanted to jump right into things.
Let's go.
Okay, great. Before getting into some of your suggestions and prescriptions, I wanted to explain to our listeners the general framework of why in some countries natural resources have been a cause for corruption. I once heard you say that in some countries there is no representation because there is no need for taxation.
Yes, sure. I think I don't want to dwell too much on the downside, because the key message of the Plundered Planet is that properly harnessed, all these natural assets are a massive opportunity for the poorest societies on Earth. And so there's a big upside potential. But it's also clear that there's a downside. The history of resource extraction in the poorest countries is a pretty sad one. It's a history of plunder in two senses. One is the few expropriating what should be benefiting the many, and the other is the present expropriating what should belong equally to the future. And plunder happens with natural assets unless you've got decent governance in place to prevent it. One of the reasons you tend not to have decent governance in place is precisely the mechanism you just outlined, that in the presence of a lot of natural resources, there's not much need to tax. And without taxation, citizens are not provoked into that core public good of scrutiny.
And one reason why this is so important in 2010 and beyond is that there are so many natural resources in very poor countries that have yet to be discovered. And as you've said it, by hook or by crook, these resources will be discovered.
And probably by crook, you know. These are the last frontiers for resource discovery on the planet. One of the most amazing statistics in the Plundered Planet is if you take the typical square mile of the countries of the bottom billion and compare it with the typical square mile of the rich countries of the world, you look underneath it, so far only one-fifth of the natural assets have been found in the poorest countries. That's not because there's less down there, it's just that there's been less search. And with high commodity prices globally, that search is going to happen over the next decade. So the big story of the next decade is going to be resource discoveries in the poorest countries on Earth. I mean, you may remember just a few months ago, the New York Times headline story was, underneath Afghanistan, there's $1 trillion of subsoil assets. That's the sort of story we're beginning to see again and again in the poorest countries in the world.
And to try to influence change in this area, well, you talk about the different sets of decisions that are involved with respect to natural resource extraction, starting, as you just talked about, with the discovery and the surveying process.
Absolutely. I mean, the whole one reason why things go wrong so often is that to go right, to actually harness natural resources for prosperity, requires a long decision chain to go right. And it's a chain, each step's got to go right. And the first step in the chain is, of course, discover your natural assets. And so far, we know that chain's gone wrong. That's why so little has been discovered. The first step in rectifying that is, I think, to get better public geological information. Very often, governments just don't know what they've got. And that creates what economists call asymmetric information, that the resource extraction companies much better understand what prospecting rights are worth than do governments. So getting some decent public geological information is a very good first step, a good initial investment. You know, about a month ago, I had the good fortune to spend an hour with the CEO of one of the biggest mineral extraction companies on Earth, one of the absolute, you know, sort of top three resource extraction companies. And I said to him, look, I think governments should get this public geological information before they start negotiating. And I thought he'd be opposed to that. Instead, he said, of course they should. They get much better deals. Now, he should know because he's sitting on the other side of the table, you know. So that's kind of first link in the chain. Know, have some clue about what you've got. Afghanistan, the government now does have some clue about what it's got, but that's because the Americans actually spent the resources to do that prospecting. That's very rare at the moment, and it needs to become much more common.
And the second link in the chain you describe is capturing the natural asset, the taxing of the natural resource.
I mean, tax is a nasty word, but the reality is unless these natural assets are taxed, then what should benefit the many ends up benefiting the few. That's the root reality. And all too often at the moment, the tax regimes in the poorest countries are really ineptly designed. You know, the Chinese in the so-called Democratic Republic of the Congo have just negotiated a 25-year tax exemption deal, 25 years tax-free resource extraction. That's at one extreme, but it's all too common that tax systems are not well designed to capture revenues for society.
And then you go on to talk about how to spend the tax revenue between consumption and saving for the future.
That's right. That's probably the key decision is to recognize that the revenues from the depletion of natural assets are not sustainable. The natural assets are going to run out. Even ethically, I think we're not entitled to just burn up natural assets that belong equally to the future unless we pass on value. And so we should be using a substantial proportion, let's say about half of the revenues from these natural assets to accumulate other assets, man-made assets. And that's the savings decision. Sometimes that happens, but very often in poor countries, practically nothing is saved. And so it all goes into public consumption, which is then just unsustainable.
And in passing on the value, you've mentioned that different cultures from around the world, from Kuwait, a Muslim culture, to a Christian cultures, to Milton Friedman and his idea of permanent income, agree that some of the value extracted from the natural resource should be preserved for the future.
That's right. I think and actually since writing the book, I've become more and more convinced about that, that it's common to a very wide range of ethical frameworks, this idea of our responsibility to the future. In the Christian tradition, it's the concept of stewardship, and the parable of the talents in St. Luke is a really good exposition of, we're not curators of natural artifacts. In the parable of the talents, the servant who literally wraps up the talents and hands them back, he's told, no, you got it wrong. The ones who are praised are the ones who invested the talents and as a result have more to show. They've fructified those talents. And that's, I think, the right ethical framework of stewardship of nature. We don't always have to preserve it, but we do have to use it for the good of the future as well as the good of ourselves.
And then the last or the fourth set of decisions that you speak about in the book is how to invest the money. As you say, invest in investing.
That's right. And it's a critical step because the reason why a lot of these societies are so short of capital is that they've not mastered the art of investing productively. You know, that's one reason why we had the debt crisis, was they borrowed money, but they didn't manage to invest it productively. And investing it productively is not easy. It's a matter of building a set of competences. Building those competences itself takes effort, and that's why I call it investing in investing.
And that
idea is now getting a lot of traction, I should say, in certainly in Africa, because it resonates with Africans that this is something that they haven't done but they need to do.
And with respect to these four sets of decisions that you lay out in your suggestions, can you talk a little bit about potential implementation? Are these places where certain types of international standards could benefit? How do you see these being potentially promulgated?
Right. So the first of all, these decisions are decisions for the societies of the resource-rich poor countries. They have to take these decisions. These are not decisions that can be taken for them. No external actor has much power to influence these decisions. They're going to be taken internally. It's a vital matter that the sad history of resource extraction isn't repeated, and so behavior has to change. The decisions have to go differently this time than they did last time. And the key argument in the Plundered Planet is that the only way that's going to happen is if society by society, a critical mass of informed citizens builds up that understands the decision chain and understands why it really matters. Now, how can that be done? I think international guidelines, voluntary international standards can really play a part. And so one of the things that I suggested in the bottom billion, and which has really been taken up by a lot of people, is the idea of building a set of voluntary international standards. And it now exists in something called the Natural Resource Charter. And the Natural Resource Charter, anybody can visit. There's a website, naturalresourcecharter.org. And it's an entirely southern-run organization where the head is Ernesto Zedillo, the former president of Mexico. There are two very distinguished Africans, a very distinguished Chinese, a very distinguished Egyptian. That's the board. And the whole spirit of that board is, here's a big opportunity which we don't want our own societies to waste. And what the Natural Resource Charter does is set out this chain of principles so that individual journalists, citizens, civil servants, ministers in the resource-rich societies can see, as it were, what the key decisions are, ultimately can see what's the quality of the decisions that have been taken in their own society and why those decisions really matter for the future of the society. So that's been the approach, is building this critical mass of informed citizens. And frankly, I can't see any alternative approach.
And you do talk about technology in the role of helping to inform people in a society.
That's right. Technology is on our side. You know this famous old statistic, 6 degrees of separation? There are only six people between you and anybody else on Earth. The new information technology lets us rip through those six steps at the speed of light. So anybody can reach anybody now. And that's the big technological improvement that we've got to harness in spreading information, in spreading understanding. And that is really starting to happen big time. Certainly within Africa, there's a lot of interest in the Natural Resource Charter, both at the level of governments and of ordinary citizens, partly because it's not seen, you know, this is not the North wagging fingers at the South. This is a Southern effort to make a difference.
But as you do mention, while there's a ton being written on the ins and outs of aid and a lot of discussion on that, there's still, overall, not a ton being said about the extraction of natural resources.
And it's been a hugely neglected issue relative to its importance. You know, the money from natural resource extraction is going to dwarf aid, remittances, foreign investment. This is the big story. The poorest societies will succeed or fail largely by whether they get this decision chain right or not. And yet for every article about that, there's probably 100 articles about is aid good, is aid bad. I remember talking with one African president recently, and we discovered between us that he'd got four senior civil servants, working on natural resource extraction issue when his country had discovered something like $50 billion of oil. I put it to him, look, you've got thousands of civil servants working on the aid relationship, and the aid relationship is a few hundred million dollars a year. This is $50 billion, and you've got four civil servants on it. Both internationally and within these societies, there's got to be a refocusing on what really matters.
And to broach the food and fishery area of your book, it still astonishes me the damage that crony capitalism, subsidies, whether they're farm subsidies or fish subsidies, due to the ultimate, what they do to the ultimate goal in these areas, obviously in food, to make sure that agricultural outputs can keep up with the demand, and in fisheries that the ocean stock do not become completely depleted.
Absolutely. It's just extraordinary. And if we take the food story, the biofuels scam in America produced a huge diversion of subsidies into something which is really a very inefficient way of generating energy, but which did succeed in taking a huge slug of grain output out of the world food market. And that contributed to the world food crisis of 2008, undoubtedly. It wasn't the sole cause, but it made a bad situation worse. And that was just a subsidy scam by the American agricultural lobby, which hit some of the poorest people on earth. That food crisis hurt the especially the children of the urban poor in the poorest societies. If we turn to fisheries, globally we're paying subsidies to fishermen of something around $30 billion a year. And what they're using that $30 billion for is to plunder the world's fish stocks so that our grandchildren won't have fish. This is massively inept. Fishermen should be paying us for the rights to catch these natural resources, and instead we're paying them to plunder them.
And when talking about the general discussion of environmentalism and natural resources, you lay out the spectrum of the debate, characterizing one end of the spectrum as the romantics and the opposite end as the ostriches. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, the environmentalism has a very valuable insight, which is that the future has rights, which we must respect. Directed, all that huge force of environmentalism is a major force for good. But at one end of environmentalism is the romantics, who kind of want to return us to the, you know, to the sort of pre-industrial world, want to preserve nature. Preserving nature is just not consistent with getting rid of global poverty, because natural assets are the big assets of the poorest societies, and they need to use and harness those assets. So the romantics really need to face the realities of global poverty and of how we feed a world of 9 billion people. The ostriches are kind of in denial that there's a problem of natural assets. They're in denial that governance, good governance of natural assets, is critical for their management. If we leave natural assets unregulated, we will get plunder of one or other form: the present stealing from the future, the few stealing from the many. We've seen that repeatedly, and so the task is to get effective regulation. You'd have thought that after the appalling events of the financial crisis, the case for effective regulation would be made pretty strongly, and yet it doesn't seem to be.
I heard you say in an interview that you wrote this book to try and find common ground between the environmentalists and the economists. In the spirit of common ground, I saw you at the Monk debates on a different side of the debate than Hernando de Soto, who's a past guest on this program. But I don't really see tension between his main premise of the importance of a legal system of property rights that and the functions that it brings, clearly identifiable interests, permitting the existence of credit, and so on, and your prescriptions in both the bottom billion and the plundered planet. And in the plundered planet, I saw that you argued for the importance of clear property titles and the benefits. I just wanted to say this because I think that both ideas are so important, and the Monk debates may have created this potentially false choice.
I absolutely agree with that, and I'm glad you said it. There's a lot of, if you like, sort of political theater around. Good theater is polarized positions. I see myself very much as a centrist, somebody who tries to build a strong, a robust, a broad-based central position. Because political theater is organized as one side against another side, sometimes I'm forced into the position of speaking on one side or another rather than speaking for a strong central position. And whenever possible, I try and speak out for that strong central position. In fact, I very seldom now accept engagements which kind of force into a one side versus another side structure. I think it's a very dysfunctional structure.
Maybe if I could come up with some good uniting and common ground questions, I could set up a discussion with both you and Mr. DeSoto on this program.
I'd be delighted.
That's fabulous. Thank you so much for everything, Professor Collier.
Thanks very much indeed. Goodbye for now.
Goodbye. Thanks for listening to the Logic Consortium in our conversation with Paul Collier about his book, The Plundered Planet, and the idea of natural resource extraction and its potential to be harnessed for the good of societies, among a number of other things. Hopefully we're going to have him on to talk with Mr. Hernando de Soto in the near future. We'll see about that. So to find out about our show, go to Logic Consortium. You can search it anywhere. And for our past shows, if you want to suggest anything, let us know. Have a great day.